gentlemen. Welcome to Money and Markets with John Titus and Catherine Alston Fitz on the Saleri Report. John is in his office, and I'm back in Hickory Valley.
Yeah, in my office, where the sun is shining brightly outside today. It's wonderful.
Yeah, spring is here. Spring is here.
Yeah, it's my favorite time of year. Summer gets a little bit too weltering where I am.
Yeah. So tell us our theme.
The theme this week is the Paul O'Neill problem, which I didn't even know there was a Paul O'Neill problem until yesterday when you told me about it.
So Paul O'Neill was the executive who turned around Alcoa. And the story of his turning around Alcoa is one of my favorite business stories. And Paul O'Neill came in, he'd been head of OMB, so some of the board and investors thought he was kind of a government guy. And he came in and he did a sort of analysis of the company and announced that his number one priority was worker safety. And some of the board members and the investors, the big investors, got very concerned. They were like, this guy's a government guy. He's never going to turn around Alcoa. And, right. And of course, he did turn around. He took Alcoa's safety record to a whole new level.
Right.
So he certainly produced incredible excellence in worker safety. But in the process of getting everybody to think that life is important and people are important and, you know, everything is important, he literally revolutionized the culture of the company. And the financial results eventually were fantastic.
Right. So, and he did what Wall Street itself and what the financial engineers couldn't do, which was he quintupled revenue from $3 billion to $15 billion. And he said to Wall Street, listen, you guys think there's an acceptable level of deaths and accidents on the job? There isn't. The acceptable level is zero. We need to focus on that. And that's when Wall Street lost its mind and said, this guy's cuckoo. But he wasn't.
No, he wasn't at all, because a successful business is a living system. It's not a machine. And Wall Street keeps trying to turn it into a machine. When, I was trained and was an investment banker at Dillon Reed. And one of the claims to fame by Clarence Dillon was he had an A-share, B-share model, because he said, you know, the engineers needed to run the factory and Wall Street needed to be not in a control position. And that's because a successful business is a living system. What you're watching now with AI and really, AI is a cover story, but AI is integrating digital technology to produce, you know, sort of central control, is you're watching the Paul O'Neill problem explode. And the pandemic, I told you, the number one thing I look at when I look at a company for Saleri Screen is I look at the governance and management. And the first thing I'm looking for is to make sure they don't have a Paul O'Neill problem. And that the number of companies who have a Paul O'Neill problem is skyrocketing. And we're going to talk about one that, you know, long ago got booted off the screen and has one of the worst Paul O'Neill problems we've ever seen. And that's Boeing.
Yeah. Okay. That's who?
Boeing.
Yeah, we're going to see. Boeing's got a major Paul O'Neill problem, but they're not alone. We're going to see that too.
Absolutely.
That they're not by themselves. But we should point out, you mentioned Paul O'Neill being head of OMB, Office of Management and Budget. He was also the U.S. Treasury Secretary. Same guy whose name is on your dollar bills.
He came to Treasury and he did two things that deeply offended the second Bush administration. The second is he told them that their estimate on what the Iraq war would cost was way too low. And the second thing is he hired two guys to figure out what the real debt was of the U.S. Treasury. And that went up on the website, came down 2 days later. You know, and within a week or two, Paul O'Neill was gone. He was the guy who wrote the book with the journalist and told the story of Carl Rivers, Rove saying, you know, we're our own empire. We make up our reality.
Yeah, you follow us. You follow our narrative. We write it and you follow it.
Right. The sort of Victoria Nuland genre. Right.
Yeah. And anyway, we mentioned last week, she is out.
Right. I think it's, for me, it's unbelievably useful to have an understanding of what made Paul O'Neill so successful as a CEO and what that means for all of us, particularly in a time when they're trying to turn everything and everybody into a machine.
Right.
Right.
Right. It's not working, and it's not even working for their own stated purposes of increasing the bottom line, and that's part of the lesson of the Paul O'Neill problem.
Right, but I see absolutely no indication that they have any intention to change from the plan.
No. We'll go back to what we said before.
Double down.
The criminal elites only, they're it's a one-trick pony, and the trick is double down on your losing strategy.
Right.
Yep, that's it. Okay. Not a really good trick. It's a kind of a lethal trick, suicidal trick, but that's their trick. So, okay, you ready?
Yep, well, let's go.
Let's get into it. We'll bat lead off again with genocide in Gaza. You know, we've been covering Israel's basic slander of the UN Relief Works Association. That's been going on. We have a new story this week that's rounded out from the cradle. UNRWA staffers tortured by Israeli troops to falsely admit Hamas links. And that was Israel's attack. It's like, we can't give them money. They're Hamas people. Well, now we learned an unpublished report from the UNRWA said some of its employees released from Israeli detention were tortured into falsely stating that the agency was Hamas linked and that staff took part in the October 7th attacks. So according to Reuters, the report included allegations of abuse and torture in Israeli detention, including, get this, severe physical beatings, waterboarding and threats to harm family members. But wait, there's more. In addition to describing torture, the report stated that Israel has subjected detainees more broadly to beatings, humiliations, threats, dog attacks, and sexual violence. But wait, there's more. Some detainees have also died after Israel denied them medical treatment, the report added. So they're murdering people just to slander them, the UNRWA. That's their playbook.
So why would Israel do this and let this out? I keep coming back to my old expression, God does not bless a mess. And, you know, Israel has always in these situations made a mess. But this time, you know, they're not getting away with keeping the mess covered up. And, you know,
they're going for broke. The gloves are off and the mask is off. And the mask is off big time through reports just like that.
Right.
Right? They mean right. business. They did not come to play in Gaza. They came to exterminate all of Gaza and right. all the Gazans,
right.
all the Palestinians in Gaza. They're wiping them out. We have a right. whole Holocaust going on in real time, and the media is absolutely silent about it. But that's the reality.
They want the land, and they want the oil and gas.
Right.
That's it.
That's it.
That's simple. Right.
So that's where we are. That's what you're up against there. So cope yes. with that. Right?
Right.
Okay. Let's turn to Ukraine, where things are not going as advertised at all. Ukraine winning. That story is no longer tenable in any way. Now we're starting to cope with losing. And our story, we have two stories this week. The first from Simplicius, who we've had before, the sit rep from March 7. Macron raises rhetoric, temperature, first HIMARS kill, Black Sea fleet setbacks, and more. So it's just a bunch of stuff. But the interesting part we want to talk about is the Washington Post article he zeroes in on that has some interesting disclosures. Next comes another WAPO piece, if only for one potentially jaw-dropping revelation it offers. And he goes down here. Big bombshell, here we go. Sirsky, the new general over there, now that Zeluzny's out, has been tasked with auditing the existing armed forces to find more combat-eligible troops. After Zelensky's office recently announced that of the 1 million people who have been mobilized, only about 300,000 have fought at the front lines. So nearly a month after his promotion, no one in the military leadership or the presidential administration has explained where those 700,000 other troops are or what they've been doing. Recently, Ukrainian officials have continued to claim there are upwards of 700,000 to a million Ukrainians in the armed forces, but have also specified that 250,000 to 300,000 or less are on the actual front line. So no matter how you slice that story, there's 500,000 Ukrainian troops that are unaccounted for. They're either probably AWOL or dead.
Right.
This war has been a disaster just almost a fatal disaster for Ukraine. That's how bad it is.
Yeah, but I would say it's successful for the people who are doing it.
For the Newlands of the world, it's pretty much success. But so, I want to.
So if you want to clean out the population, you know, you've gotten how many? You've gotten 8 million to leave over the, you know, since 2014, and now you've cleaned out the young men, and you've got a tabula rasa, right?
Basically, I mean, the last time we checked, the population of Ukraine had sunk below 20 million. It was like 19 some odd. You know, and with stories like that, it's like, well, what do you got left? You don't have any soldiers left.
Well, so here's the question. And the question is, does Russia want more territory or not? And if they do, what happens? If they don't, what happens? Because it doesn't seem to me like anybody's suing for peace. Now, I don't know if you saw it. The Pope came out and said, you know, essentially they needed to make peace with the Russians, and Zelensky's resisting.
Yes.
And it seems to me that the neocons just bring chaos. Their goal is to keep running this out if they can. Nuland leaving says maybe they can't. And so then the question is, okay, well, how do you make a deal? And if you're Putin, how do you make a deal with people who won't keep a deal?
You don't. You just keep doing what you're doing. And remember, he had two objectives at the front end of the special military operation. He said, we're going to denazify Ukraine.
Right.
Okay, just that. Just stop there. Denazify. That means we're going to go until Zelensky's out because he's a Nazi. We're just going to keep we're going to keep going.
But I think what denazification means is we want the biolabs gone.
I think it includes that, yes.
Right. So if you look at what is the threat to security is missiles within a certain distance and the biowarfare labs.
That's the other thing. We're not going to have NATO on our doorstep. That's another of the special military operations goals.
Right. So how do you clean out if they're, you know, estimated to be 30 biowarfare labs, how do you clean those out without taking over the whole country?
Do you keep going? They're just going to keep. They're west of Avdiivka now. They're just pressing on, and it's a turkey shoot. It's at this point it is becoming a turkey shoot. Let's run the next story. The last story in war in Ukraine is a clip, and I want to show you this clip. There's a lot of the kind of a background obnoxious music going on, so I've really toned that down. Pay attention to the subtitles and super titles in this video, and watch what the Russians have to say now. This is the first story we've got on the Paul O'Neill problem. We said Boeing's not the only company with a Paul O'Neill problem. Another company with a Paul O'Neill problem is called General Dynamics. And their vaunted Abrams tank, which was sent over like, oh, yeah, wait until our Abrams tank gets there. Well, Russia waited a week, and now we're going to see how the Abrams tank did over in Ukraine. Here we go. And what the Russians think about it. Three tanks gone already. Ouch. Please send more of your Abrams tanks because we get bonuses for picking them off.
It's back to the fact that the Russian military is organized more to be economically efficient, whereas the U.S. military has many political agendas. And
yes.
Ultimately, that very rich cost-plus infrastructure does not produce an effective military, but it does produce a lot of stock market profits.
Yes, it does. But as the Paul O'Neill story, or the legend of Paul O'Neill, proves and shows, it illustrates, is that this hyper focus on the bottom line isn't the way to optimize your bottom line.
Right. Right, but I assure you, if Paul O'Neill walked into any company that does a large business with the U.S. government right now, he'd be out in a year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Paul O'Neill story number two. This is another video of an ATF agent. Okay. This is on a nationally syndicated program on Sunday morning, Face the Nation. This is a huge multi-million member audience watching this. And this agent is going to, this is Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is going to try to disassemble a Glock, and it doesn't work. I'm going to apologize in advance for the sort of there's an overlaid audio commentary in this, but with no further ado, let's run this clip.
And Chris is here. He's one of our leading experts. So that's the frame.
Holy shit.
Come on, mama.
Cleveland Steamer.
My nigga.
No!
Dick, shit, shit! Piece of shit!
Holy the fuck! Go touch his dick!
And then they could buy the aftermarket parts and attach that, simply attach that on.
And to buy those parts.
Firearms parts alone, mm-hmm. Right? Then it's not a frame or receiver.
Parts are not regulated.
And they're not regulated. Under the law, we're not allowed to do that.
You right? would like to do that?
That's up to Congress to determine. But, I mean, what we did is we tried to work with the law that Congress gave us and take the receiver.
That is unbelievable. I can't. It's not. Face the Nation's not a live show. Why didn't they just reshoot that? That's incredible.
Well, first of all, I'm assuming the guy clearly knows how to, you know, disassemble and reassemble a Glock. So why that gun, you know, why he couldn't do it, I don't know. The whole thing is baffling. First of all, the fact that, you know, they didn't set up the scene with a gun that had been pre-tested and was, you know, and right. everything was working. So why wasn't the advance work done properly? That's number one. Then number two, exactly what you said. Why wouldn't you pre-record it? Why would you run that?
Right.
Unless you're trying to make people look incompetent, which is, you know, if you track the Biden administration, it seems to be the desired thing.
Here's what I don't know about Face the Nation. I don't know when the show is recorded. Maybe it's not recorded on Saturday. Maybe it is recorded like early Sunday morning, and there just wasn't enough time to reshoot it. And it's like, you got to go with this. You know, it's like Godfather 3. There's a scene where Sofia Coppola looks at the camera. It's like, well, the only reason that's the best take you got. She's looking at the camera. Yeah. So maybe they had to go with that because it was either that or no show, no segment.
I don't know.
That's amazing, though, him not being able to. I mean, and it's not just right. one little glitch. It's repeatedly he can't get this Glock to come apart.
Working. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not just slide here. You know, that's unbelievable. But that's a Paul O'Neill problem. Like, you've got people now
right.
peppered throughout this administration at the highest levels who don't know what they're doing.
Well, here's the thing. I bet you that guy does know how to assemble and disassemble a Glock.
You know what he doesn't know how to do? He didn't know how to assemble and disassemble a Glock on TV. That's right. What he doesn't know. He didn't practice. You got to practice that a million times, guy.
Yeah, you got to practice. Right.
You can't mess around. You can't let that happen.
Or somebody set him up. I mean, that's theoretically possible, but I doubt it.
Don't know. That's a question for another day. That's not a good look. Right. Sorry.
Right.
That's no matter how you slice that, that's total in-your-face incompetence at the highest level.
And the marketing thereof.
Yeah, that's just
I can tell this one really upset you.
Just astounds me. This the ineptitude at the highest levels, because I saw it. I saw it inside the corporate world. I walked away from it. It's like, you don't know what you're doing.
Well, but you here's know? The thing, John. What I watched from 1989 on is people are promoted because they will go with the flow.
Yeah.
And so the productive are constantly pushed out. And then you end up with cascading polonial problems. Right. So.
Yeah. It's okay. Let's go to the headline, Paul O'Neill problem, Boeing. And here we just have a series of headline and a video. Boeing has had a disastrous week in terms of its planes basically falling apart in real time. The series of headlines, shocking. This is from Daily Mail in the UK. Shocking moment, a Boeing 737's engine exploded and burst into flames, forcing a heart-pounding emergency landing. They have a video in here. It's, anyway, if you click the link, you'll find it. Next up, we've got United Boeing, is again from Daily Mail. United Boeing 737 MAX veers off the runway into the grass after a gear collapse at Houston Airport. And the FAA launches a new probe after a litany of safety issues. Okay. Next up, we've got at least 50 injured after technical problems caused strong movement on Boeing flight. This is from Just the News. And finally, we've got a video here. Let me cut over to this and just run this video. And I want you to pay attention to kind of watch these wheels. Okay. That's where the action is going to be. But let me click this video, get it running. The wheels and goodbye. You like Jesus. That? Yeah. And then if you read the article, you'll see pictures of the wheel landed in a rental car parking lot. And just, those are big wheels.
Yep.
And they do a lot of damage when they're dropped from the sky like that. As it turns out, they just crush cars. Not a good week and not a good look for Boeing.
Right. And there were more since we got these, there've been more.
Three more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Boeing wasn't done. Boeing, what we just saw was batting practice.
Right.
Yeah.
And now people are looking for those stories and advertising them when they happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Meanwhile, in legal land, this story just blew me away. Let's just go to the source of it. The Corporate Crime Reporter. This is a very kind of staid, conservative publication. So, I mean, it's just an industry trade rag kind of. Corporate Crime Reporter. Boeing whistleblower found dead in Charleston after break and depositions. Boeing whistleblower John Barnett was found dead in his truck at a hotel in Charleston, South Carolina, after a break and depositions in a whistleblower retaliation lawsuit. Knowles, his attorney, wrote that Barnett was supposed to do day three of his deposition. So it's a three-day deposition. Barnett was actually called as a witness by Boeing, okay? So the deposition is going to be, Boeing's going to question Barnett. And so Barnett's own attorney, Knowles, is going to cross-examine. Normally you think of cross-examining as being adverse.
Right.
But in this circumstance, it's a friendly cross-examination. So let's get back to it. Okay, so it's a 3-day deposition. The defense, that's Boeing, examined him for their allowed 7 hours under the rules on Thursday. I, Knowles, cross-examined him all day yesterday and did not finish. We agreed to continue this morning at 10 a.m. Co-counsel kept calling him in the morning, and his, Barnett's, phone would go into voicemail. We then asked the hotel to check on him. They found him in his truck, dead from an alleged self-inflicted gunshot. Wow.
I did a news spot last night on Coast to Coast, and it was reported that this guy had shot himself, as though that was fact. So I give the chances of that being true less than 1%. There's no way this guy shot himself.
No.
It didn't happen. And if you...
No.
You know, one, a kill decision was made after hearing, you know, his first day cross-examined by his attorney. So somebody was listening. In my experience, and, you know, it's been a long time since I've been inside, a kill like a corporation or a law firm can't make the decision to just do the kill. You need a committee. A committee needs to approve this kind of kill. And this is a very, this is a message. This is not subtle. Yeah,
absolutely.
They could have arranged a heart attack. They didn't have to arrange it's unbelievable.
Yeah, listen, the notion that it's a suicide is just risible. The guy already, once you cross that threshold and you turn against the corporation, that's it. Once you've made that decision, there's no going back. Right. And in a way, once you do that, and it's going to cost you a lot of money, and it's going to cost you a lot of future jobs. But once you've done it, because I've done it and you've done it, it's liberating. You feel good. You don't kill yourself. It's like the worst part's over. I rip the Band-Aid off. I don't rip the Band-Aid off and then blow my head off. That's retarded.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I wasn't a whistleblower. I left the Bush administration and I said, we need a plan B. So I was simply trying to come up with a way for communities to generate fantastic wealth for the pension funds, you know, getting government money out. So I was decentralizing, but I wasn't whistleblowing on anything. The problem was, if the decentralization worked, it stopped the black budget fraud, right?
Right.
So you have a competition, you know, if everybody leaves drug dealing and goes to work at $10 an hour at the local data servicing center, you know, not good for drugs. And if the mortgage fraud stops, not good for the black budget. So, but I was working on the positive. I was the target of a whistleblower. So in other words, I was the target of a key tam suit, and they were, you know, it was the government stooge who was the whistleblower against me. That's why it's always funny when people say that I'm a whistleblower.
But like, you were out telling the truth about the system. You were exposing the fraud that was really, it wasn't local to one company. It wasn't just going to hurt Boeing. You were exposing the big fraud.
I was threatening the whole model.
Yeah.
Right. They were centralizing in a way that destroyed wealth. And I was able to prove you could decentralize in a way that would create wealth and that they were destroying wealth. Now, I wasn't shouting that to the rooftops, but
No, but you were doing damage. There was you couldn't turn back once you did that.
Right.
There's no turning back, and you knew it. Did the idea of taking your own life ever cross your mind?
No, never.
Yeah.
I did. Right. I remember one time, you know, I had just heard, because I've never understand revelations. I've tried to understand revelations, but I can't understand revelations. But you know, you have all these people who are into the rapture. So I've tried to understand the rapture. And we had this book series on, you know, Left Behind about the rapture. And you'd see cars in the South that said, you know, in event of the rapture, this car will be unmanned. You know, so I would try and understand the rapture. And I remember I had a particularly bad day with the Department of Justice. And I remember looking up the ceiling and I said, Lord, if the rapture came right now, I would not be disappointed. Anyway, but I used to warn people, you know, if they tell you I committed suicide. Didn't happen.
And the notion that Barnett guy shot himself is absurd.
Well, but if you they only said a little bit about some of the things he has been saying. But if you look at them, what they're saying about, you know, they need parts and they find the parts that have essentially been thrown away. I mean, it's pretty scary what, you know, the little I've read that he said.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And the timing, too, it's in the middle of his cross, right?
Right. Well, whatever he was going to do the next day, they didn't want that on the record.
Right. He'd done enough damage.
Right.
Right. And that they're going to cap it.
They cap
it. Let's keep it going. You know, we give J.P. Morgan
Do you know who was representing Boeing?
No. It could be, I don't know. I'm going to guess.
Well, we need to find that out.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's just these law firms are just puppets. It's ridiculous.
Well, but if you look at how I'm interested in how the kill order worked. So I'm gonna.
Firm's not gonna tell you anything. It's just.
Of course, they're not gonna tell me anything.
It's gonna be a cookie cutter big name law firm. That's it. You know, it could be Preston Gates. Could be Boies Schiller. Who knows?
Yeah, I'll see. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going. We give J.P. Morgan a lot of grief, but this is a reminder that all the too-big-to-fail banks are all bad. This report from the House Judiciary Committee is on Bank of America. This is unbelievable. And how the Bank of America is mixed up with the FBI. Financial surveillance in the United States. How federal law enforcement commandeered financial institutions to spy on Americans. Okay? March 6th, so it's recent. Okay. And I've just, to be clear, I've excised parts of this report, maybe 3-4 pages of it, and I'm going to zero in on just the key parts about Bank of America. Okay. According to the FBI, an American citizen's opposition to firearms regulations, open borders, or COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccine mandates all of which are viewpoints protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution, feed into an existing narrative many DVEs, that's a domestic violent extremist, subscribe to regarding the U.S. government's exercise of power. Put another way, expressing a belief in the existence of the deep state, support for typical conservative policies with respect to firearms or immigration, or doubt about the conventional narrative may result in an individual being labeled by the FBI as a DVE, domestic violent extremist actor, and likely to pose an increasing threat at lawful protests, rallies, and demonstrations. So that's what the FBI thinks about America. That's their mindset. That's the backdrop of what they're doing with that, what they're doing with Bank of America. Now let's get to Bank of America. Okay. Here's an email from the FBI, which you can see here. It's been redacted, but they leave in the identifying source. From the FBI to Bank of America, bofa.com. The email says, ahead of next week's inauguration, I wanted to touch base on a couple of things. If either or both of you have time this morning to discuss SAR, suspicious activity reports, and a couple of ideas, that would be great. In a subsequent email, just a couple of hours later, the FBI told B of A, thanks for the very quick communication over the phone this morning. To recap our morning call, we, the FBI, are prepared to action the following thresholds immediately, supplying B of A with a broad search thresholds for querying the financial transactions of its customers for potential matches. The FBI explained that it is interested in all financial relationships of any B of A customer transacting in Washington, D.C. on around January 6, 2021, and that made any historical purchase of a firearm or that had purchased a hotel, Airbnb, or online air travel within a given date range. Just one day later, B of A confirmed to the FBI that it was doing some work around the parameters we discussed, and we should have something for you by the end of the weekend. B of A delivered on the promise. The massive search request sent directly to from the FBI to Bank of America appears to have occurred via direct email, get this, without any legal process or individualized criminal nexus.
So B of A offered up a fishing expedition for the convenience of the FBA.
Yes.
No law, no warrant, no legal process, nothing. Just
no. And nothing, nothing even colorably legal. There's no individualized criminal nexus. You couldn't even defend this. This is absolutely indefensible what the FBI did and what B of A did helping FBI.
So the FBI was part of organizing and engineering an operation. You know, it was the faked insurrection. Sort of it's an interesting twist on a false flag.
Yes.
And they're trying to create different narratives. And so they're trolling the data to see what narratives they can create.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right.
And they're using the personal data of innocent people to engineer a fix.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, that's exactly right. They're going to use that information. The NSA and the CIA, they do this all the time. They collect the information, they build a case against the person, and then they tell local law enforcement how to sort of reverse engineer the information you gather to make it look like you collected this information legitimately.
So Bank of America helped the FBI try and set up and falsify evidence against their customers.
Yeah. You have to remember, Bank of America is a company that foreclosed on a guy who did not have a mortgage. He paid cash for his house. This is a criminal enterprise. Why anybody would bank with Bank of America is utterly beyond me. I don't know.
So why is it? Because I know there's somebody listening to this who banks at Bank of America.
Because the thought process is, well, Bank of America is smart, and I'm smart by banking with them because they are too big to fail.
That's not what I hear. What I hear is I'm unimportant. I'm not important. And it doesn't matter where I bank because my account's small and it's unimportant.
The other thing I hear is it's convenient. Like
I dated
someone in New York who said, listen, that's a convenient branch for me. And I'm just going to keep banking. And Bank of America eventually ripped her off.
But they feel safe. And that's, you know, that to me is the mind control. How can you possibly feel safe banking with somebody who does this?
You couldn't. If you thought it through, you absolutely could not feel safe banking with somebody like that. They'll do anything. I mean, listen, if they steal a guy's house And if they'll without a warrant, search your records and help the FBI, like Mr. Helper, what won't they do? You think they're going to hesitate to snuff your account out and lie about it? Of course not.
So I've been having this kind of conversation, not on Bank of America, but on Treasury Direct. I can't tell you how many people in the last week I have heard propose or recommend Treasury Direct. Okay? So The idea being, you're afraid of the great taking. They may take your securities. So what you should do is you should sell the securities in your brokerage account and go to the Treasury and invest all the money in Treasury Direct. Okay, now let me keep going. We know that between 1995 or 1998 and 2015, the money that went into the Treasury disappeared out the back door. They've refused to produce financial statements. When S&P tried to drop their rating, they almost destroyed the holding company and, you know, the president got fired. So they won't permit honest ratings, right? And they won't obey the laws related to financial management. Why would you trust that organization to honor their obligation to you over the next 5 to 10 years? Would you?
Well, where else do you put your money if you're not going to put them in treasuries?
There are hundreds of places to put your money.
Okay, like name one. It should be easy to name one if there's hundreds.
Absolutely. You can. I mean, I told you the story of the guy who wanted out of the stock market, and I said, refinance your kids' mortgages. He refinanced all 5 mortgages. You know, and every month he gets a check for, five checks, one each from his kids.
Right. But Bank of America turns around and forecloses on your house anyway.
Yeah, but, you know, you've got standing in court. Come on. You know, that guy was out of town for a year. That's why it got behind.
Bank of America did this millions of times. They went into millions of times. They went in with ginned up affidavits, false affidavits, false evidence. The Linda Green, this is April 2011. On
what you're coming back to is that if there's no law, there's no law as it relates to any asset, which is in fact true. But there are assets right now that have more risk than less risk. And the answer for somebody, if you're afraid the bad guys are going to take your securities, why would you cash out your securities and give them to the guys who are going to take them when they're taking the money out the back door? Why would you just give it to them?
I think insofar as the Treasury is concerned, I would be much more comfortable with a paper bond than with an electronic bond. Now, whether you can get that, I don't know. But I do know you can get...
If you put your money in Treasury, you're financing Gaza. You're financing the Ukraine. You're financing... Why would you want to help them finance these things?
There's only so many places you can put your money in a banking system, okay? You can put them in a bank, or you can go to the Treasury. That's really it. You can convert assets. You can buy assets that you physically possess, and that may be a good idea.
A bank and an asset manager are required in certain ways. So a bank has limited options as to where it can put in, you know, the money. But right. I, as an individual, there are a tremendous number of places, if I want a bond, that I can invest it in a bond, which is creditworthy and the money's going for a good purpose.
The asset managers have to use the banking system, too. It's not like they have a vault where they put your money. No, they
but
use banks.
But I'm an individual. I don't have to invest money in crime. I can invest money in productive activity. I would much rather invest in a company that does not have a polonial problem. The U.S. Treasury has the ultimate polonial problem. Look at the Abrams tank. Perfect example.
Yeah.
Don't you want your money going to something productive?
I invest my money myself.
Right. Exactly. There you go.
Stuff I can touch and hold.
Right. There you go.
I don't trust any of these people. But I don't think the case for distrusting the Treasury over the banking system is a very good one.
Okay, well, you and I have a 180-degree disagreement on this one.
Yeah. To trust Bank of America over U.S. Treasury is insane.
Oh, I would never trust Bank of America over U.S. Treasury.
That's what you're doing when you refinance the mortgage. That's exactly what you're doing.
No. To me, Bank of America, you know, a New York Fed or San Francisco Fed member bank and the Treasury are one and the same. There's one federal financial.
No, they're not. They're not the same. You need to go reread the Bloomberg case where they say The New York Fed is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act request, but the Board of Governors is. They're not the same. They are different.
As a legal matter, you're absolutely correct. As a political and business, as a political and business matter, which, you know, part of the risk issues are business and economic, they are one operation. And they love to do the Alphonse Gestoff, no, that's different than this, though, no, that's different. But if you look at how they're managed and they're run, they're one as the federal finances are run as one integrated entity.
Okay, if that's true, then why would you trust the U.S. Treasury less than Bank of America?
I would trust both of them zero.
Okay, so then why is it a bad idea to put your money in the U.S. Treasury direct, but a good idea to refinance your mortgage?
I think it's a dreadful idea to put your money in either of them.
Oh, okay.
I was trained to never. You know, I was trained by the guys who ran the financial system. You never finance your enemy, ever. Never. You never do that. And so I think you putting your money into John Titus is a great investment. I mean, if you go back and you look for 10 years, I was an investment advisor. And if you look at what created wealth, it was people putting money in themselves or their own enterprises. That's how they created wealth. So, you know, you put your money in something that's productive and works for you. You don't put your money with criminals.
Yeah.
I mean, I would no more invest with the Russian mafia than the man in the moon.
Right.
Same way.
Right.
You know, and I feel the same way about Bank of America, and I feel the same way about Treasury Direct.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think physical assets and things that like that add to your intellectual capital here.
Right.
It's self-education. That's a good investment to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
And you're a good investment of your time to do things. Just invest in yourself. Do things creatively. You know, it's to stop this hyper focus like Wall Street had with Alcoa on what are you talking about with safety?
Right.
You know. Okay. Yeah. Invest in flesh and bone for sure. Okay.
I don't know if. If you could invest in something real or something productive, putting your money in something unproductive to me is insane.
Yeah, right. It's counterproductive.
Right.
Agreed. Let's go to a surreality that we're living with day to day. I had to include this clip. I watched this whole thing. I just couldn't believe it. This is the clip of President Biden giving a speech. And the speech is, it's the usual Biden thing where he's having trouble with words and he's saying stuff that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But what's interesting about this clip is I want the camera is the cameraman and he pans over and look at the crowd. I want subscribers to look at the crowd. The camera pans right and then it pans left. Look at the crowd and ask yourself, does the visual of the crowd you're seeing match the sounds you're hearing? Like, what's going on here? Okay, here's Biden. Let's roll this.
15 million new jobs in just 3 years. That's a record.
Okay, a lot of cheering.
800 new manufacturing jobs. They said, where's it written that we can't be the manufacturing capital of the world? Unemployment at a 50-year low. So far, and under Donald Trump, Black and Latino unemployment skyrocketed. Under my administration, we have record low Black and Latino unemployment. Donald Trump, Asian American unemployment nearly doubled. Now the employment rate of Asian Americans is the highest it's been since 2008. Look, we cut Black child poverty in half, cut Latino poverty by records as well. We're seeing the fastest rate of new Latino businesses all over this decade. And the next 30 years, it's going to even be bigger. Look, folks, more people have health insurance than ever before.
Wow. I mean, the crowd looks bored or perplexed by what they're looking at.
Yeah.
And yet you hear the whoopering and hollering. Like, where's it coming from? No, right. I don't see anybody in any of those pans saying anything, much less cheering.
So here is what is astonishing. If you look at how much money is being shoveled out to win people in this campaign from the Democratic side. I mean, this administration is shoveling out remarkable amounts of money. And, you know, and so it if it wasn't, you wouldn't even see those people there.
Yeah. Okay. I want to show a frame, just a single frame from a campaign. It's not necessarily from the same event, but it's a Biden-Harris campaign event. It's just a picture of the setup before it starts, before Biden shows up. And here it is. So you can see it's a small affair, but it's on the scale of the one we just saw. You know, maybe you got 120 people in there. But look at the center here is where the press corps is. And this is the section. Let me get another color. This is the section that you didn't see in the clip. The camera panned over here and it panned over here.
Right.
This is where the sound is coming from in the center and includes the press. And I just point that out. Like this reality that Joe Biden's like, he doesn't have any, he's in Atlanta. Okay. He's in Atlanta, Georgia. He should have a decent amount of support there. And he doesn't have any real support from what I saw.
There's no real support.
No, the notion.
And without shoveling
out
all that money, the room would be empty.
Right.
Right.
The room would be empty. Right. Right. There's people look at him like, what are you talking about? Like 800 manufacturing jobs. It's going to make us a power. 800. Really? What are you talking about, guy?
So Trump this week locked up the Republican nomination and right. is said to be cleaning out the RNC. But here's the, if you look at both sides, what we're talking about is, you know, and if you look at both sides, what's coming from both sides is frightening.
It is. In fact, there's not a single candidate among the three viable candidates right now. I'm including RFK Jr., who has any sympathy whatsoever for the Palestinians, for the Gazans.
Right.
Right. And right. two of them, the big two, are pro-vaccine to the hilt.
Right. So the problem is, if you're not going to stand up to them in Gaza, how are you going to stand up when it comes to protecting the U.S. Treasury?
You're not.
That's the problem.
Right.
And the message to all of us has to be, we're on our own.
Yes.
And yeah. what I see at the State House is the rape of America is being teed up.
Right. If you think it's okay to go rape and plunder throughout Gaza because there's no legal restraint on the government,
right.
then what legal constraint do you think is going to stop them from raping and plundering your house and killing you?
They're coming.
I'm at a loss for that. I just don't get that mentality.
If you sit at the State House, the tsunami of proposals and bills rolling through, teeing up that rape, and even a breakup of the country, it's a tsunami.
Yeah.
So, and there are plenty of people fighting the good fight, but, you know, the war is going to be a ground war, and it won't be decided in Washington's already decided which side they're on.
Yes. They've already decided which side they're on.
Right.
Okay, let's keep it going in FedWatch. And return to a story we talked about last week concerning farms and a declining number of farms. There's an interesting kind of footnote in this next story about that. Over 140,000 farms lost in 5 years. And we're talking about 2017 to 2022. And we saw these numbers last week. Number of farms declined by 7%, declined by 142,000. But what I want to look at is, and that's a big drop, but let's go all the way down to figures. I think it's 9 and 10. Yeah, here we go. Look at this. Not as bad as you might think. Acres operated by farm typology, 2017-2022. That's it. So 2017 is on the left, 2022 on the right. So look at this. In 2017, family-held operations make up 91.7% of acres operated and 97.2% of total operations. 5 years later, the numbers really aren't any different. Family-held operations make up 91% of acres operated and 97% of total operations. And if you look at figure 10, percentage of acres operated other than by non-family corporate farms, right? So those are the big corporations. The vast majority of them are dominated by non-family corporate farms. So I just wanted to offer those up as sort of good news.
Right.
That, yeah, they're plundering and they're consolidating, but by and large, the farmland in the U.S. is doing pretty well.
So in May, we'll be at there a whole group of us. Massey will be there. Pete Kennedy will be there. I'll be there. We'll be at the Rogue Food Conference at Swope in Swope, Virginia with Polyface Farm. And I mentioned that because Joel Salatin has made it a business over the last 20 years to help teach people how to be farmers and create new profitable farms.
Oh, so,
yeah. Great. You have a huge, as the baby boomers age, you have a huge number of farmers who are going to retire or sell out, and plenty of home builders who want that land. So,
yeah, there are people in my family who are farmers in that exact bracket.
Right.
And I don't know what they're going to do. I'll see them at the family reunion in July and ask them.
Right. Yeah. Most of them don't have kids who want to take over the farm.
That's my question. Is like, are you going to hand this to your kids? Maybe the answer is yes. You know, I'd love to know anyway.
Right.
But you're exactly right. They're in that baby boomer demographic.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, well, they're looking tired. I mean, it's hard work.
It's very hard work.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard work.
Yeah. It's
that's why Salatin's teaching people, because he's teaching them how to be highly profitable. The key is to make the profit go. And to do that, you've got to have a direct relationship with retail. In other words, when you're wholesale, you get squeezed out. The guy who makes the money is the guy who has a direct connection with retail. So the question is, how do you establish that relationship with retail and make it work for you economically? So and Salatin was able to do it because he just went to war with the regulators.
I'd need help on that. I don't know. I have the first clue on how to do that. Yeah.
Well, I think I told you when the litigation started, I turned to Carolyn and I said, we're going to have to find a way to go retail. And she looked at me and she said, good luck with that, honey. You know, it's hard to do. No, it's hard to do.
Right, right.
It's a shocking conversion.
It is. Yeah. Yep. Okay, let's wrap it up in FedWatch in New York, okay? This next story, you got to shake your head. Okay. What is this? This is another Daily Mail story. New York City Mayor Eric Adams, but he's not alone. It's also a New York story, New York State. New York City Mayor Eric Adams rolls out stop and search plans for bags on the subway and vows to bring in weapon screening systems to crack down on violent repeat criminals network. Like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Violent repeat criminals, you're going to roll out bag checkers? Okay, here we go. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has slammed a failure to stop repeat offenders as the Big Apple grapples with the surge in subway crimes. He noted, this is Adams pointing this out, 38 people, okay, in New York City, 38 people were arrested for 1,100-plus attacks on transit workers in 2023. 542 people were arrested last year for over 7,600 shoplifting crimes. Okay, so maybe, I don't know, you should prosecute them to the full extent of the law? Keep them in jail? What do you think? Nope, not going to do that.
So our interview this week is Bobby Ann Cox talking about the healthcare regulation that allows you to pick up and quarantine somebody whether they're sick or not. There's no, you don't have to prove anything. They don't have to be sick. You can just pick them up. And you can also pick up their property to be used in the quarantine. So you're basically free to kidnap and keep somebody with no due process forever if you want.
Yeah. So the solution to a few bad apples in the barrel is to quarantine or just put a dragnet over the whole barrel?
You know something? If you think that the New York PD can't put away 38 people, you are wrong. And if they're not doing it, you know, it's a plan.
Right. So let's look at how they're going to, they know who they are. It's the same 38 people or 542 people. They know who they are. So what's the solution? Adams is deploying 94 bag checking teams across 136 stations among 472 total subway stations in New York City. These efforts are set to, so that's the city. These efforts are set to be bolstered by almost 1,000 New York State police, MTA police, and National Guard troops deployed to help the subway bag checks, it announced Wednesday. Like, huh?
Control.
It makes no sense whatsoever.
New York is the center of the U.S. financial system, and they want complete control. And
yes,
this is simply how you go about getting it, because you can't sell complete control to educated people who are used to being free. You need pandemics, and you need 38 guys. For all we know, they're paying those 38 guys to run around and do this. Now, they can find a lot of crazy people in New York, so maybe they don't have to pay them. But I don't buy any of it. Everything's a lie.
That story. It's not even a lie. It's just stupid.
Right.
It's just a stupid story. Like, well, 38 people are committing all the crimes. So what we're going to do is we're going to stop and frisk everybody. What do you think?
Well, 38 guys are creating all the crimes. So we're going to torture everybody else who's not creating crimes.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Right. We don't do anything to them. We've let them go repeatedly. Why wouldn't we keep letting them go?
Our operatives are shooting up schools. Therefore, we're going to take guns away from the people who are not shooting up schools.
Yep. Okay, let's go. Let's move to space, military, and global turf wars, where we have one story this week that's slightly less ridiculous than the last story, but just slightly. Why are Al Jazeera? Why are people blaming the Houthis for cutting the Red Sea cables? Well, gosh, I wonder. Officials in the U.S. say undersea telecommunications cables in the Red Sea were cut on Tuesday, disrupting 25% of traffic, data traffic between Asia and Europe. Okay. Now, the Houthis, as you know, they're not bashful about bragging and saying, we sank that ship and we attacked that craft, that vessel with a drone. Okay? They'll tell you who they're going after. We're going after ships to Israel. So let's go back to the story. Four out of nearly 20 submarine cables in the Red Sea were cut on Tuesday, according to HGC Global Communications, which operates the cables. The Houthis have issued a statement denying responsibility for cutting the cables. So they admit we sink ships and we attack ships, but they deny cutting the cables. And so why? What's going on here? Some experts believe the Houthis would need help from an ally. I see. So those cables were cut because the Houthis had an ally to help them cut the cables, while others have said they could be capable of causing damage on their own.
Yeah, it was probably the U.S. Navy.
So let's review. Nord Stream, we brag for years that we're going to take the Nord Stream out. From everybody from Ted Cruz to Biden saying we're going to take Nord Stream 2 out. Then we take it out with the Navy, as documented repeatedly by a number of different journalists, and then we deny doing it. Right? Now cables are cut underwater, just like the underwater operation Nord Stream, and we're going to blame the Houthis, but it's not just them. They probably couldn't do that. They need somebody like Iran to help them.
So I grew up in West Philadelphia, and I know all about black teenagers controlling a $500 billion narcotics trafficking global business, right?
Yep.
Right. This is it. We're back to the black teenagers. So
yep.
It's phenomenal. When you see the financial, the financial system is under stress. Because there are two stories that for the last 20 years always pop out at a moment of financial stress. One is underground sea cables are cut. That's number one. And number two, we have a magical breakthrough energy research development that will make magical, breakthrough energy available anywhere from 1 to 10 years. And usually it's some defense contractor that controls the patent, right? Okay.
Yes.
So the story is, stop transparency and communication. So censorship by cutting cables and you wonder what financial trades were on those cables.
My favorite tall tale of all time, though, despite everything you just said, which is hilarious, was 3 days before the Afghan war in Afghanistan becomes the longest war and U.S. history. A story comes out like, hey, whoa, you know what? We just found a geological survey in Afghanistan. We found $1 trillion worth of minerals, gold, silver, cadmium, underground. We're going to mine it out. It's worth it. The whole war is worth it. How'd that work out? How much of that $1 trillion did we get?
You know we can't beat guys with sandals. You know we can't beat guys with sandals. You know?
Unbelievable. Okay. The stories are just so ludicrous.
The most unbelievable story, so far this week is still coming up.
Okay.
Matt, our friend Jay Powell, right?
I'm on it.
Okay.
Let's go.
Let's go.
To Jay Powell. So we're in Hey Robot.
Uh-huh.
And there's three kind of CBDC crypto stories this week. Here we go. Number one, Jay Powell. Powell says, don't worry about CBDC. I can't even make it through the headline. Powell says, don't worry about CBDC. It's not happening anytime soon. Look at him. He's a guy serious, okay? People don't need to worry about a central bank digital currency. Nothing like that is remotely close to happening anytime soon, not even remotely close. We're nowhere near recommending, let alone adopting, a central bank currency in any form, okay? In any form, retail or wholesale. Most concerns relate to a retail CBDC. However, the reference to any form could relate to a wholesale CBDC for interbank payments. I'm kind of inclined to credit Powell on that. To me, that means they're just not going to call it a CBDC.
So a couple things. So if you look at a couple years ago, the BIS started this innovation hub to implement CBDCs globally.
Right.
And they did innovation hubs in, I think, 7 locations, but a strategic partnership with the Fed. And they had the Boston Fed working with MIT, and Gensler was running that project on how to do a CBDC and all sorts of other things. Now, here's what's interesting. The Richmond Fed has a scope of work out for a CBDC product developer, and the New York Fed has put out, I think, 6 scopes of work. Just put them out to hire CBDC product developers, and they're paying $150,000 to $200,000, but they're not remotely close to doing a CBDC. They're just putting out scopes of work and spending millions of dollars to hire people to implement CBDCs, right?
Yeah. Well, you gotta remember though, Powell, he is a lawyer, right? Where did he practice anyway? Where did he cut his teeth? It's a big white shoe New York.
Yeah, it was a white shoe law firm before he went to Dillon.
Davis Polk. He's a Davis Polk guy. Close. You know, if they come out with a CBDC in a year, he'd say, "Yeah, that we weren't remotely close." Just like I told you, a year is a long way away.
Well, so one of the big stories at Dillon at Solaria this week is I asked Corey Lynn to do an article on Visa and MasterCard, because I believe absolutely ultimately, you know, if we look at what just Bank of America just did, and then what Visa and MasterCard are doing with the codes that work in either the credit card or the banking system, you can implement total control with an all digital system with the banks and the credit card companies who are clearly on board to do complete control.
Right. Right. Yeah, you know, he's right. Right.
Right. This is a ruse. And given that they have scopes of work outstanding to hire people at 150 to 200,000 to implement CBDCs, you know, I have to say, Powell has been very careful in my experience not to mislead or engage in material omission. He just went across the line. He just lied.
You think so?
That's a total, he's playing a lawyer trick here.
Yeah, I think that's my read on it. He's not lying. He's vaguing.
So let's go back to litigation versus business. So I'm thinking, you know, here we're an investor. Here's the lawyer. He's not lying because you're right. A year from now is remote.
Right.
Or if he's going to use Ripple instead of a private system,
exactly.
You know, then it's not a CBDC. Or if he's going to use Ripple and MasterCard and Visa, it's not a CBDC.
Right.
So he's playing legal trick from a business standpoint.
That's how I read that. Yeah.
What I got to tell you is it's a total lie. He's lying flat out.
From a conversational standpoint, if you did that, I'd say, hey, why are you lying to me? You're gaslighting me, bud.
Right.
But it's up to the, it's up to people in the House and the Senate to pull tighten the thumbscrews on this guy and start asking the right questions. They're not doing it.
So here's what's interesting. I've had a couple of, you know, working with different state legislators, I've had a couple of, I'm starting to see people getting feedback from the from Congress, and what they're saying is, we got a problem. You got to worry about this.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
The state legislators do not yet understand the extent of the problem, but they're beginning to. And one of that, you know, some of that message is coming through from Washington. There's a problem. This is dangerous. And the fact that Powell just did this says it's getting more dangerous to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
Now, he has said he needs legislation to do CBDC.
Well, that's constitutional law 101.
Right.
Of course he does.
But the question is, can he do it all with fast payments, MasterCard, Visa, the banking system, and Ripple, so that he doesn't need legislation?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Boy, that's a risk these guys aren't going to take. That's a risk. I don't see him doing that. That's because
they're going to get as close as they can to an all digital system without legislation. I think.
I disagree. They're going to have to front it, and they'll do it in a bunch of different ways. They'll do
so
it.
When do you do it? Do you do it after the election
you gin up some high cyber attack.
Yes, so it's a Patriot attack. It's a Patriot Act.
That's the playbook, in my view. They got the legislations out there waiting. They're waiting for the false flag. That's how I would look at that.
But they have to get operationally, they have to get clear on what they want before they do that.
Yes. Right. Yes. Okay. Lest you think that there's greener pastures on the other side of the world, in particular BRICS. Let's cut to the next story. It's a little up. This is one of those. I'm going to have to change the view here a little bit. There we go. From CoinDesk Policy, BRICS will create payment systems based on digital currencies and blockchain, according to a report. Let's look here. The five-nation BRICS group comprising Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa will work on creating a payment system, on blockchain and digital technologies. A report by Russian news agency TASS said, so straight from the horse's mouth. The effort is part of a specific task for this year to increase the role of BRICS in an international monetary system. For some time now, the BRICS grouping has been making efforts to reduce its reliance on U.S. dollar and settlement, also known as de-dollarization. So the greener pastures are being pitched as de-dollarization, but make no mistake about it, it is digitization that everybody is after.
Right, but they also don't say which currency they're going to use. It's not clear.
It is not clear. What currency are you going to use? And lest you think that blockchain is safe, let's go to our next story. Hey Robot, this is from the UK. Let me cut over here. I never know if this is Cointelegraph or Cointelegraph. Let's just say Cointelegraph. UK authorities will soon have fewer restrictions when seizing crypto. Oh, isn't that great? The UK government recently released a statutory instrument documentation stating the UK law enforcement authorities will be able to freeze crypto assets used in crime. You know it's coming, without requiring a conviction from the end of April, okay? This expands the power of the National Crime Agency to confiscate and seize crypto assets the agency suspects are linked to suspicious illicit activities, without needing to go through extensive legal procedures,
they don't need to be sure. They just need to have a, you know.
Yeah, there's a suspicion. I'm suspicious.
I'm worried. I'm worried that might be. They're making too much money. It might be suspicious.
These procedures, this due process is too. That's too pesky. So what? Okay, authorities will be able to retrieve crypto assets directly from exchanges and custodian wallet providers. They will also have the option to destroy crypto assets if needed. So, you think you're safe in crypto? Go read that story as many times as it takes you to understand you're not.
But, John, I can go to Fidelity or BlackRock and buy Bitcoin, right, through an ETF.
That's awesome.
Now, if I go to the exchanges or I trade, you know, off exchange directly, that could be seized. But I know if I go to Fidelity and BlackRock, I'm safe.
Yeah.
In fact, right. This could herd people into Fidelity and BlackRock, right?
Yes.
What a coincidence.
Yes. Right. Yeah. It could get right. people to Fidelity and BlackRock. Yeah.
Right. And the great thing about having a custodian at Fidelity and BlackRock is you don't really need the Bitcoin, right?
No, you don't. That's
right.
A great point.
It's just an IOU in, you know, traded and priced in Bitcoin.
Wow. Wow. That's, I feel so secure.
Yeah. Well, you know, London does it again. What can I tell you?
Larry Fink owes me the invisible computer currency.
Yep. Yep. Wow.
I'm going to rest well tonight.
This is what I call a herding technique.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Okay. Right. Let's change gears to Farmageddon and see what we're up against here. The CDC. CDC released a 148-page study on myocarditis after COVID-19 vaccination, and every single page is completely redacted. This must be a new record. They've got the image here, and you can see the pages are all imaged, and it looks like an LED panel. Just all blank white lights there, completely redacted. Is the CDC just the agent of Albert Bourla and Pfizer or what?
You know, here's the thing. The attitude is we don't have to obey the law.
Yeah, right.
You know.
It's just out in the open.
I don't know if you remember, but there was a time after we Skidmore did his first report, he put in a FOIA and we got a copy of a document coming back from the Navy. Every number. So this is an audit report on the finances. Every number in the report was redacted. And I think the whole title was redacted. So nothing made any sense. You couldn't understand a word it said. And Skidmore sent it to me and he said, can this happen? And I said, you know, I've never seen it before, but I guess now it can. So.
Yep. You saw that 148 pages blank. That's just denying. That's just refusing to answer the request. Yeah. There's no difference. There's no material difference at all. Between saying F you and
right.
that.
So the guys from GATA put in a FOIA request to Treasury related to the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And they got back something that said there are no documents related. You know, we have no documents related to the Exchange Stability Fund. So the guys from GATA called me and said, you know, they don't have any documents. I said, no, they didn't say that.
Right.
They said they had no right. documents, you know, for the Exchange Stability Fund. And he said, oh, I'm sure that's just a typo. I said, no, it's not. Put in another FOIA and explain that it's not the Exchange Stability Fund that you want. It's the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
No, you put in a FOIA and you put in one for Exchange Stability Fund and another for the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Done.
They had no documents related to the Stability Fund because there is none.
Right. There's no such thing. And they know that.
Of course they know that. Of course they know that. But they were going to fall for it. They didn't.
Yeah, it's not
you know, they couldn't. Right. Right.
That's pettifogging. That's sleazy pettifoggery 101. They teach that early. Okay.
Well, the reason somebody is going to push for financial control is if you look at the speed at which the not the rule of law is deteriorating, but the appearance of the rule of law is deteriorating. It's deteriorating fast.
That's an important thing to note, and this right. has been going on for a long time. Where it's the appearance. It's the open denigration of the rule of law. That's been the strategy now for basically 12 years,
right?
For a dozen years, this has been going on. It really got going late in the in Obama's first administration.
Right.
Yep. Okay, let's keep it going in Farmageddon. Remember the story we had on trusted messengers and hairdressers? You remember that one?
Yes, I do.
Okay, you got to hire the hairdressers to help push your pro-vaccine message. This one's probably a little closer to home for a lot of subscribers. This comes to churches, okay? The U.S. government coerced leaders of faith to push COVID-19 vaccines on Americans. What if I told you Powerful U.S. government officials, such as former NIH Director Francis Collins and U.S. Surgeon General, used religion in an attempt to convince faith leaders around the country to push COVID-19 injections. A deep dive into the organization Faiths for Vaccines. Okay, so there's two entities here we want to concentrate on. Organization Faith for Vaccines, which is a founding member of the HHS vaccine propaganda machine, COVID-19 Community Corps, has revealed just that. So they're in knee-deep with religious leaders. Let's focus on this first. COVID-19 Community Corps, what is that? Let's go to the government website. There you go. We can do this. COVID-19 Community Corps is a national volunteer, COVID-19 Community Corps, Department of Health and Human Services. It's an initiative to galvanize, there you go, trusted men messengers in the fight against COVID-19. So it's a propaganda organization. Let's go back to the story. There's 86 founding members of this group, of the COVID-19 Community Corps, okay? 86 founding members of the faith leaders category of the COVID-19 Community Corps was the most numerous, okay? With 86 founding members in the faith leaders category, it's the biggest member of the government's propaganda campaign there. The writers say, in our opinion, though, and there's a lot of money going to these organizations, but the writers here say it really wasn't the financial incentives that convinced faith leaders to push COVID-19 vaccines on their members. Instead, it was a strategy that baselessly appealed to faith leaders' deeply held moral and religious beliefs, targeting their virtues instead of their vices. For example, at a May 2021 National Summit for Faith Leaders, NIH Director Francis Collins, referred to as Reverend Doctor, even though he has no religious training at all, would address hundreds of faith leaders across the nation, claiming the COVID-19 vaccines were God's literal answer to prayer and urging faith leaders to believe that pushing the shots was a love your neighbor moment. I want to point out here that Faith for Vaccines, a founding member of the COVID-19 Community Corps, just to get an idea of the scope of this thing, Faith for Vaccines has over 1,000 faith leaders across the U.S. as members. And that's what they're doing. It's a big-time operation.
You know, I will never forget, one of my favorite preachers before the pandemic started was a preacher from New York named Tim Keller. And I'd had a subscriber who was a member of his congregation that started to send me his tapes. And I really admired him. And right before the pandemic started, I decided I would buy all of his books because I was worried, you know, if I don't get them now, I should just stockpile them. Right. And I did. And then the pandemic started. He had gotten cancer and so was weak, but went on, what's the show done by Brzezinski's daughter? I forget what her name is. Do you remember?
You got me.
The hit lady, whatever her name is. But he gets on with them on this major news show promoting the injection. And I thought, I'm watching Tim Keller promoting the mark of the beast.
Yeah.
That, and suddenly everything I'd ever read and heard from Tim Keller was somehow negated in my mind. And it was, you know, here was somebody who I really admired and I had really studied, you know, what he had to teach, and I'd really learned a lot from him. And then suddenly, boom, it's all negated. And it was
I saw that. You know, there was a lot of people I followed who kind of taught me, you know, during the financial crisis, 08, 09, 2010. And then I was like, well, these are trusted people. And then along comes COVID and they get taken or paid hook, line, and sinker by this fake pandemic and by the solution to the fake pandemic of vaccines. Like, are you kidding me?
Right.
I lost it. So I understand your Tim Keller moment, totally. I've had that many times. Like, look, I'm done with you. The last 12 years, down the toilet. See ya.
I have to say, the co-opting of the churches I've watched since 1995 has been extraordinary. I've also seen the preachers who wouldn't play ball on the COVID injection. I've seen the pressure they bring on them. It's extraordinary. Don't think that targeting isn't one by one in this country. It's one by one. It's one by one in the United States, and it's getting that way in Europe, too.
I'll bet.
Right.
Let's go to, on that point, go to our next story, even though it's a pushback story. It's our first story in pushback. So we're done with Farmageddon. Now let's go to pushback. A very interesting story from West Virginia. And this is not just on the COVID-19 injection. This is vaccines in general. So West Virginia is starting to realize, hey, you know, maybe vaccine is not the best thing. Medical professionals call on justice to veto school vaccine bill. They got this bill. So here are your medical professionals who, frankly, is one of the most unmotivated assemblages of human beings I've ever seen in a photograph. But there's a bill that would loosen West Virginia's school vaccine requirements. It's going to the desk of Jim Justice, the governor of West Virginia. And some medical professionals are urging him not to sign the legislation into law. As it is now, state law requires students to be vaccinated against a series of contagious diseases, such as polio and measles, unless they have been granted an exemption due to a medical reason. There's no exemption for religious grounds. The new bill, though, would allow the state's 143 private or parochial schools to develop their own rules for vaccines. It would also allow students attending virtual schools, but not in-person classes, to be exempted from vaccine requirements. So it's a pretty narrow exemption, and yet these highly motivated people are all up in arms against this, despite its small size. The state is among five that do not allow philosophical or religious exemptions to school-mandated vaccine requirements. Interesting. So West Virginia is a leading proponent and a leading enforcer of, you know, mandatory vaccinations. So the powers that be are losing ground here. But I want to scroll down to this little tidbit at the end. Look at this. Speaking of faith leaders, quote, Christ's command to love our neighbor includes taking the proper steps to protect one another from harm and immunizations, have long and successful track records of protecting children, said Tim Bishop, Director of Marketing and Communication for the Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston. There you go. You like that? It's your religious obligation, says the religious guy, to take your vaccine.
Given what I know about the vaccine-heavy schedule, you know, I consider that murder with the pen.
Yeah.
You know, you can kill with a pen.
And yet you've got this. We saw how small it's private schools, parochial schools, online students. Not very many people we're talking about. But they are up in arms. They got their faith leaders out there telling you it's your moral and religious duty to take that vaccine. Like, are you kidding me?
You know, I've been sitting at the State House while they've been, you know, there's bills going on related to the vaccination of the livestock. You know, because they want to put mRNA vaccinations in all livestock, all meat. And it's war. And one of the things to understand is if you look at this kind of legislation at the State House, the war over this stuff is unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Really?
And what's unbelievable is how much support there is for poisoning the population, whether the livestock population or the human population.
Where's that support for poisoning the population coming from? And in what form does it take?
It's coming from decades and decades of government money and subsidy. You know, program after program after program. And budget after budget after budget.
Is the support municipal or is it private institutions?
It's both. But what you've got is you've got, you know, for example, you've got Farm Bureau. You know, you've got the doctors' associations. You've got the veterinarian associations.
Yeah.
Everybody's on the dole.
And trade associations.
I mean, the simple primary trend that we're looking at, which is coming to a head, is you have In any state, you have the federal constitution and the state constitution. So in Tennessee, an incoming legislature, you know, basically takes an oath of office related to both. So a Tennessee state legislator is obligated to obey the U.S. and the state constitution. But if you look at what the federal government has been doing for decades, it's been buying people out of that with money. And so, you know, essentially we all agree to teach our children to be sex slaves so that we can get the $2 billion of federal aid, you know, implementing things which are clearly outside of the best interests of the children and the Constitution, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're coming down to a world where, you know, is it, do you want the money or do you want the law? Which is it? You can't have both.
Right. Let me ask you this, because that's interesting about the trade associations, but how visible are lobbyists in the effort to poison the population?
Very.
Really? So it's just, it's an army of lobbyists and trade associations, both.
It's an army of lobbyists. It's an army of trade associations. And I have to tell you, it's an army of liars, people who lie to themselves, people who lie to each other, people who, you know.
But in what capacity are the liars who aren't lobbyists and who aren't trade associations, in what capacity are the garden variety liars acting?
Well, there are many. So you have the civil service, you have the politicians, you yeah. have the media, you know, who are, you know, and different people lobbying. You have the lobbyists and you have the trade associations.
Wow.
You have citizens coming in and, you know, putting in their emailing and calling. So, you know, don't.
For sure, you're going to have some astroturfers. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Unbelievable astroturfers.
Yeah.
But if you look, one of the things that, so you have all these different groups, but if you look at what really makes it tricky, go back and look at the beginning of the pandemic. You constantly had people coming into the hospital who were perfectly healthy, but were terrified that they were sick and constantly wanted to be tested and constantly right. wanted prescriptions yeah. and constantly wanted, you know, attention. And they would literally make themselves sick and even get themselves killed because they couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
And so there was a marketing campaign. And what I would say is it used, you know, very clever tactics of disinformation, propaganda, and entrainment and subliminal programming. And you talked a whole world of people into lobbying for the things that would poison them.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And not only lobbying for them, but going along with, you know, why would anybody go along with a lockdown of 20 small businesses right next to a Costco that remains open? Why would the Rotary, why would any politician who wanted to have a tax base allow all their small businesses to be wiped and the market share to be moved to publicly traded companies for free? I mean, it was a huge,
right.
I can't even guess. I mean, you know, everybody's worried about a great taking. Do you know the taking of market share that happened?
It was incredible. The whole thing was just preposterous.
Right.
And people are just swallowing hook, line, and sinker. Well, of course, the big box stores get to stay open. And of course, the liquor stores have to stay open, but the church is closed. Like, what is wrong with you?
Right. Right. But here's the thing. If you look at that, you know, I don't know if you want to call it a media machine or an entrainment machine, because it's not just media. It is entrainment. So it's coming in all directions. That machinery can cause people, you know, it can get hundreds of thousands of people to go to Washington on January 6th, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And walk right into a trap.
Yeah, even though I think the principal actors weren't people coming from, you know, flyover country. I think the principal actors in that farce were paid.
Right. Oh, of course. But yeah. I mean, people did get in buses and, you know, and come.
I know.
And come to Washington. But yeah. So part of the problem in the state house is you're dealing with waves of engineered concern. That is, you know, of people who are not acting in their best interest.
Yes. Right.
Right. So right. you are in a war with idiocracy.
I just watched a scene from that movie recently.
Oh God.
So hard. I could not
really
stop laughing.
I cannot watch that movie. I've never been able to watch it.
Watch the scene with the doctor. Doctor and Luke Wilson, I think it is.
I've never been able to make it through that movie, so I'll try.
Doctor talking about how his ex-wife was retarded, and she's now an airline pilot. I mean, I was laughing so hard. Anyway, it's a disturbingly prescient movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's keep it going and push back. This next shows that boycotts are very effective from the cradle. Starbucks West Asia franchisee sacks over 2,000 workers after boycotts. So, you know, Starbucks is a big supporter of Israel, and they got boycotted. Starbucks West Asia franchisee began to terminate over 2,000 of its employees on March 3rd as a result of the boycott against Israel's war on Gaza, according to Reuters. Kuwait's Alshaya Group owns the rights to operate Starbucks in West Asia and North Africa. The layoffs will cut 4% of its 50,000-strong workforce. As a result of the continually challenging trading conditions over the last 6 months, we have taken the sad and very difficult decision to reduce the number of colleagues in our Starbucks MENA stores, Alshaya said in a statement. So boycotts are very, very effective.
Yes.
Don't be told otherwise.
Yep. That's painful.
Yep. That's good. That's a good story there. And finally, a story on pushback, a subject near and dear to my heart, legal tender. This is great. Let's go right to the lawsuit. There's a lawsuit filed in the District of Columbia. And I think that non-Gazan Children's Health Defense Fund covered this, but I'm going to just use the complaint instead. This lawsuit is called Vander Werf versus National Park Service. So what's going on here? Having implemented and expanded a cashless interest fee payment scheme, defendant National Park Service no longer accepts American money at approximately 29 national parks, historic sites, monuments, historic parks around the country. Currency, U.S. currency, meaning cash and coins, is legal tender for all public charges according to 31 U.S. Code Section 5103. Plaintiff Vander Werf received unequivocal written notification from the National Park Service that she will not be permitted to enter each of the following three NPS locations that she was set to visit. They list the parks after her stated intent to use tender or intent to tender U.S. currency because they charge an admission fee. She's like, I'm going to pay in cash. They're like, don't even bother coming. Applicable law, 31 U.S.C. 5103, establishes that the United States coins and currency, including Federal Reserve notes and circulating notes of Federal Reserve banks and national banks, are legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues. Foreign gold and silver coins are not legal tender for debts. So that lawsuit is on. That's one to keep your eye on. That lawsuit
right, that's
there.
That's Ray Flores, and it is yep. Children's Health Defense financing it. So okay. They're backing it, and it's good because they understand the dangers presented by an all-digital system to healthcare. You know, that will be the enforcement mechanism that forces all the healthcare mandates and policies that they've been trying to stop.
Yeah,
so this is a terrific, and Ray's doing a terrific job, so...
Let's keep our eye on that lawsuit because, you know, I don't remember it. I'm sure there are lawsuits out there. I just haven't researched it, but there are not that many on legal tender. That's a concept you just never hear about.
This goes right to the heart. Does the government have the ability to refuse cash?
Right.
Right.
Despite the statute, let me back up. Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress the right to coin money and regulate the value of. And Congress has said, look, 5103, 31 U.S.C., legal tender includes cash and coin.
Right.
Okay, for all public charges. You just saw that.
Right.
And now the National Park Service, which is unelected, it's an agency of the government, but it's unelected, is saying, no, we don't have to abide by that. We're going to refuse cash.
Right.
So we're going to see whether the Article 3 court can hip check, you know, an unelected administration, an unelected agency like the National Park Service. Hopefully it can. This is a good case to watch.
This is a very good case.
Yep. Okay, so let's go to charts now that we've wrapped up all the stories, and let's return to Boeing, BA. Bank of America is BAC. BA is Boeing. So let's look at this chart. 5-year chart. What do we got here? Woo.
So we have S&P on the top. We have the aerospace and defense ETF in the middle. And then Boeing at the bottom. And what you can see is from the time that Boeing, you know, the first sort of disclosures of the big problems on the, I think it was the 737 MAX, down they go. Yeah. And they keep trying to sort of work their way out and then get hit by more headlines. And so you can see tremendous, you know, you've got a 70% spread between them and their index group.
Wow, that's a big spread.
And here's the thing. If you look at what they, what they just publicly announced was the only way we can protect our stock prices by assassinating, you know, the quality managers who try and stop the deterioration of quality. So yeah. To say that this company has a, you know, a galactic sized Paul O'Neill problem is an understatement. And the market knows it. Right. The market knows it.
That's the market knows it. That's interesting. You know, Boeing is one of the five big military industrial complex members.
Right. Right.
Another one we covered this week is General Dynamics with the Abrams tank.
Right. Now, here's what's interesting. If you look at the global market for planes, you know, the big competition is foreign.
Yeah.
So this is bad news for U.S.
It's terrible news. Right.
Right.
But I'd still rather be in the U.S. than Europe, you know. Anyway, let's keep going with charts. S&P versus VGK and EEM year-to-date.
Yeah, so I just wanted to look at year-to-date how we're doing. And, of course, again, U.S. market leading the emerging markets in Europe. But, you know, equity markets up.
Yeah, not huge, not too big. It's early. You know, but
well, we're only 2.5 months in, and you're up 8.75%. That's pretty strong.
You're feeling pretty good for sure.
Yep.
Okay. Next up, gold.
Yeah. So the safety trade. So gold is strong, and silver is positive. And of course, these bonds are flat. If we looked at TLT, the treasuries, they'd be way down. So treasury's still in the dog.
This is a recent surge for gold and silver. What's up?
I think there's real, you know, it's the same thing with the breakthrough energy headlines and the shutting of sea cables. You know, there is tremendous nervousness about, lawlessness. And you say, you know, where can I put my money that's safe? If treasury's down, gold and silver is sort of the core asset you go to have central bank and, you know, central bank insurance is really what it is. So, and the inflation numbers are up. They were up a tad. That was what I was doing the news spot on last night. And it was really funny that, you know, I can believe this, the Bureau of Labor Statistics said inflation for the last year is 3.2%. So you know what my comment was? Hogwash.
What? Yeah.
Just complete hogwash.
That's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
That's preposterous. Okay, let's go to U.S. dollar index year to date again.
Yeah, so U.S. dollar off a little bit. And, I didn't check to see if it suddenly turned up after they did the breakthrough energy headline. And that
they trotted out that pony again. Yeah.
Cut the sea cables. So one of my theories, if you read State of Currency, I describe why I believe one of the key components of having a reserve currency is you have what's called a financial bazooka. But, you know, the financial bazooka does depend occasionally on cutting sea cables. So,
yeah, right.
Yeah. And making sure some people's internet doesn't work.
Hello, Ms. Fitz. Hello.
Yeah, so I got home yesterday and magically my internet and phones don't work.
Wow. We got nothing.
What an amazing coincidence.
you got carrier pigeons out there?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I'm at Nita's house, right?
Yeah, I know. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. Let's turn to last chart, Bitcoin. What a rock star. Look at this.
Yep. I told you they were going to pump it again.
70,000 plus. Whoa.
You know, after it dumped, Joe Mercola and others were saying, it's over. Bitcoin's dead. I said, no, they're going to pump it again. Why would they ever give up the opportunity? So now we're at a new high.
Look at this. I mean, this, yeah. this graph just like, I'm going up.
Yep. I told you, if they approved the ETFs, this was going to happen. Did I not tell you that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We knew that was coming.
Okay.
Anyway.
So I hate to sound like a broken record, but if you were doing swaps, okay, so if you're doing Bitcoin to Ripple or, you know, whatever, if you're doing swaps and creating taxable liabilities, promise me that you will sell some and escrow your taxes in dollars so that if you hold it past the dump, we don't end up with your tax liabilities being greater than your position.
Oh.
Okay, please escrow your taxes when you swap.
Yeah.
Okay. This is mom.
This has been
mom.
A public service announcement.
No, I always, you know something, every time I used to watch this on Wall Street, you know, I would watch it on the stock plays and the pump and dumps of the stocks. And then I, you know, when crypto started, I would watch it on crypto. And each time it happens, it makes me want to cry. So, you know, if you play in a pump and dump, you have to play tax smart.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. No doubt about that. But something tells me there will be tears.
Yes.
Right. There's a movie called There Will Be Blood. With this, there will be tears.
There will be tears.
That's the movie of the week. Okay. Let's go to Larry in-house this week with a greater taking. What's this?
Bobby Ann Cox. I saw a presentation a couple weeks ago by Bobby Ann Cox about the lawsuit she'd been litigating, and I knew it was very important. I knew it was very impressive. But I had never focused, John, on the fact that this healthcare regulation, in my opinion, was created to make sure that the New York Fed and the folks who run the financial system had complete control in New York. Okay, so let me stop you. When I did my big, you know, my various debates on Bitcoin, I kept trying to tell them, look, it's not the way the regulators control a system is not through the technology. It's by controlling the people who trade the assets. So, you know, if I want to go after exchange, I go after the guy who runs the exchange. I go after the guy who's operating the system for the exchange. I go after the people, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at the health regulations that Bobby Ann is litigating, it basically gives New York the power to quarantine any citizen without justification or reason. They don't have to be sick. There's no healthcare standard. They can grab their property or a property to do a quarantine. So right. You can grab people and you can grab properties without due process on the front end or the back end. I mean, the only way you get out is if your family can hire a lawyer and fight in the courts long enough to get you out. But there's no due process. So she won on the first round, but then on the second round, you know, it got appealed and she lost 5-0, despite the fact that she has both the law and the case law on her side. She's litigating on behalf of state legislators who are saying the governor does not have the power to make law. We, the legislators, have the power to make law. And she's representing the legislators. And she's got the law and the case law on her. So they're, of course, appealing it again. But I took one look at this and I said, Bobby, there is no way that this has anything to do with health. This has to do with controlling the New York, you know, controlling the financial system in the state of New York. Yeah. But I have to tell you, if you look at what she's litigating and if you look at the position the state is taking and you combine that with the story we just talked about with Eric Adams, you know, basically putting National Guard into the subways and going through. I mean, this is all designed for complete control within the New York state jurisdiction. And that includes Wall Street and the, you know, the whole New York Fed area, which I would point out is the depository for the U.S. government. So this is terrifying. And what this says is, you know, they don't think they can control and manage the financial system without this.
Well, that was one of the things introduced by the pandemic was the whole notion of symptomless transmission and they're symptom-free infection. Like, you're infected even though the fact you don't have a disease. It's like it threw the whole concept of disease out the window. So it's like, well, let's get rid of scientific standards and let's get rid of legal standards. There's no due process.
Let's integrate the stories. Powell is saying we're not remotely close to doing a CBDC. But meantime, the politicians who control the jurisdiction that the New York Fed and the real money at the Fed are in charge of are putting together the legal structure they need to assert complete control of the financial system, whether they have a CBDC or not. So a total control grid is snapping into place by whatever, you know, whether the mechanism comes through the bank account or whether the mechanism comes by New York State arriving at your door, they are putting into place the train tracks for total control in New York State. Yeah. Total control.
Right. We don't care what you call the digital currency. It's digital. That's the key thing. You're using digital money. We got you.
Right. And what's amazing to me is when Bobby told me that she had lost the appeal 5-0, which is extraordinary because she's got the law. I mean, the law is totally clear and the case law is totally clear. There's no.
What court was that?
What's the second court in New York when you appeal?
New York State? Actually, I think, called the Supreme Court.
I thought the Supreme Court was the first, and then you go to appeals, and then you go.
I think the Court of Appeals is the highest court there.
Yes, the highest court. So maybe it's Supreme. It was this. It was the, you know, she won the first round, and then the first appeal, she lost 5-0. And I said, look, there's only two powers in the world I know that can do that. I mean, yes, it could be a remarkable coincidence, but it's basically the New York Fed or national security, one or the other or both. So. To me, the message, whether it's the Red Sea cables getting cut or the breakthrough energy headlines or now, you know, this and Eric Adams, what it's saying is these guys are scared and they want total control.
For sure they want total control. There's no doubt.
Well, but they need total control.
Yeah.
They need it. They think they need it and they're scared. And they're pushing by whatever method they need. And they clearly don't feel comfortable to go to Congress and push on the CBDC side. So they've got all these sneaky ways of instituting total control. Yep. It's kind of like they've got 1,000 mechanisms to get total control. And you just need to be watching all of it to see where they are.
Okay. And on that score, let's go to the next thing. Speaking of CBDC, the letter, the template letter.
So we updated our template letter for you to send to your banks. We got a great comment from an ally that said, oh, this letter is way too nice. And, you ought to be rough on your bankers. What I find, John, is that there are so many people who still don't understand the threat. And it's phenomenal to me that they don't. But it's very, very important that you are... We can't get the state legislators to move unless the bankers will help them move. And so it's very important we educate the bankers. Now, if I'm a banker and the feds are my regulators or providing my, deposit insurance, I want to be very careful about my words and I don't want to say anything quotable. But we really need anything you could do to get your banker to understand that total control is underway, and if it happens, it's going to probably wipe out their business. So they need, there's a real alignment between lots of local banks and lots of local credit unions and Freedom, and we need to get it kind of stirred up and working together. So the more knowledgeable the bankers are about the need for real solutions on the ground, the better, the easier it will be to get things done at the state legislature.
Right. Because the legislature will respond to
basically
trade associations.
Right, but it's not just that. If you're a state legislator, you don't want to mess with the banking system.
Right.
Without the bankers you trust being on board to help you. You don't want to make a change unless it's a change that the bankers you know and trust think is a sound thing to do. And so you need... You know, when you make this kind of turn, you need to invent it with the bankers, not separate. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot. If you look at the state legislator, the really competent state legislators and the really competent local bankers, they really trust each other for good reason. So, you know, and this is something they need to do together. So the more the bankers are looking down the road and seeing this coming, the better off we all are.
And that's what the letter is intended to do.
Yeah, we made a commentary and we talked about it a couple of weeks ago called The Threat to Financial Transaction Freedom as my elevator pitch to state legislators or even to bankers, where we take the Carstens video, the cash carry video, and the Boley video. Each is 1 minute or less, and we just say, here's what they're going to tell you. You know, then you watch the video, here's what they told you, and we go through all three. It takes 4 to 5 minutes, and when... You know, when you walk a new person through it, they're like, oh, my God, they don't know. They don't know. And you should see their face. When you take a really smart community banker and you walk him through those three for the first time, he's like, I had no idea.
Wow.
I had no idea. And I, you know, I always tell him just
I like that the elevator pitch.
They're all so busy. I mean, they're all totally overwhelmed and busy. So when I tell them my 3 1-minute videos, it'll just take 4 minutes. And but they go through and they're like, they had no idea.
You want bang for your buck, explosion for your minute? Here you go. Watch this. Yeah,
exactly.
Speaking of financial transaction freedom, here we go.
So I just wanted to remind everybody, we have the website up, and if you want updates on what's going on in Tennessee, just sign up for the updates. And we're keeping the links and resources available. So if you want resources to help you with, you know, protecting financial transaction freedom and lots of different actions you can take, it's all there. So we send out one update, possibly 2 a week. And if you want to stay updated, don't forget the website's there.
Okay, very good. And now, batting cleanup in Malvern, PA is Catherine Austin Fitz.
Oh, did you get the link for Corey's, the Visa and MasterCard?
If I did, I didn't put it in.
Ooh, okay.
I don't think I did.
So I just want to mention, great article. One of the things we're seeing, and I hate to say this, the sound money folks are arguing for gold and silver systems, including with credit cards. One of them uses MasterCard. So I asked Corey to write an article on Visa and MasterCard because, you know, the total control system can be done with credit cards and banks. We don't need CBDCs. Right. So we're concerned about all financial transaction control. And it's so important to preserve cash and checks. So I asked Corey, and she did a great job. If you want to know, you know, if you want to know how critical Visa and MasterCard are to total control, you really, really see it's unbelievable. You know, they are fully on board and implementing it. And then, of course, we have a great event at Ratner Hunt Club in Pennsylvania on March 23rd. That's a Saturday. So, and I will be sending out instructions, but I want to remind you, Ratner does have a dress code. No blue jeans, have to wear a blazer. Don't have to wear a tie, but no blue jeans, and you do. Men do need a blazer.
Yeah, so that's next weekend, not the next coming weekend, but
yeah. So next week and on Tuesday we've got a meetup in Ohio, so we'll be in Ohio, then we'll head over to New York to do an event and a private sort of briefing, and I'll tell everybody, I think you might want to leave New York and. And then drove down to Pennsylvania. I mean, well, why would anybody stay in that jurisdiction? If you lived in New York, would you stay, John?
No, I'd be gone so long ago. I love New York. I hesitate to visit.
I don't know.
You want to be in New York when the stuff comes down the pike? No.
You know, what's that Eric Adams headline going to do for tourism in New York?
If it's among people like I know, ordinary, nothing. It's like, you know, yeah, terror, terror, terror. We got to stop terror.
I don't know.
But a lot of people are waking up, and you can see this in the banking data and in the deposit data. The people and the money are flowing south.
It's I sent you that chart? So community bank deposits are up. Big bank deposits are down.
Yeah.
So somebody's getting the message.
Yeah.
Yeah, if that's not you, if you're in Bank of America, please.
Yeah, the big four, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and JP Morgan Chase. And really, even I'd throw in a couple others. I'd throw in U.S. Bank and PNC.
Throw in Citibank.
That's one part of the big four. U.S. Yeah. It's Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and JP Morgan Chase. Those are the big four, plus the two.
If you're a leading member in the New York Fed or the San Francisco Fed, I'm out. I'm just out. So,
Bank of America's Atlanta Fed. Or, I'm sorry, Richmond Fed. Charlotte, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right. They're headquartered in Charlotte.
Okay. Yeah. Well, America has a Paul O'Neill problem, and it's spreading. And
it's percolating up. You notice into the highest levels of the administration.
You know, I as you know, I'm a huge Toby Rogers fan, and I just saw a presentation by him about what the great poisoning is doing to the economy. He's an economist, and of course, his doctorate was on the impact of autism on the sort of the economic cost of autism over the next 20 plus years. And I think the stress of the great poisoning is going to cause unbelievable Paul O'Neill problems everywhere, including with organizations that are very well intended.
I think we're watching it in real time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I look forward to next week. I don't know if it'll be, I don't know, the you know, when the system, when the buttons start to pop off the coat, so you get the you get Bitcoin flying, you get the sea cables being cut, you get the guys tortured telling the tale and the UN getting it out, you get the breakthrough energy headlines, what else are we going to get?
God only knows. Serious. There's no predicting these criminals. They are out of control.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Well, anyway, we'll see what comes next week. We know it'll be interesting, but
that we know that we can, you can guarantee you on that. It's going to be interesting, but what form it'll take is a fool's bet.
Cause you guys send us such great intelligence. I want everybody to send us the stories of the buttons popping off the coat. You know, it won't be sea cables. It won't be breakthrough energy, but there'll be others. So send us stories. Send us your best choice of the buttons popping off the coat this week. Okay? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salier Report. We'll talk to you next week.